Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Rob Baskitza. Rob is the managing editor of Boing Boing and the founder of TXT.FYI, an effectively invisible publishing platform and low-key internet cult. Hey, Rob, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you doing, Mark?
Doing really well.
It's really great to catch up with you, Rob.
Hi, Ken.
So, Rob, you are like a really creative person. I've known you for many years now, and you wear a lot of different hats at Boing Boing. You're a wonderful artist and painter.
Thank you.
You code things. You do a lot of, you're a great writer. And so you're a very interesting person. So I know you're going to have some interesting tools to talk about. I took a little peek at them. One of the things I know, you love mechanical keyboards and actively have been like searching for the best one ever. So tell us about your first pick, the Vortex mechanical keyboard.
Well, mechanical keyboards, the appeal is in the old-fashioned key switches, which have a more tactile, more clicky feel to them. And there's all sorts of different types that you can get depending on your preferences. It's just great for people who type a lot or who just don't like modern keyboards who are getting sick of butterfly keyboards from Apple. So I think anyone who listens to a tech podcast will be familiar with the cult of mechanical keyboards. A big part of the appeal is that you can swap out the keys. So there's a cottage industry of keycaps in all sorts of different color schemes and styles. So you can have a keyboard that looks like an old typewriter or one that looks like a very specific 8-bit computer that you had 30 years ago or that looks like a nuclear missile launch silo console.
Cool.
So Vortex is one of the brands. And its thing is that it makes offbeat sizes and includes Bluetooth, which is a relatively rare feature in mechanical keyboards. Mm-hmm. So they make these like tiny little 40-key keyboards that will fit in a shirt pocket. Or you can get these huge, sprawling 100-key keyboards with a condensed or otherwise bizarre layout. The one that I picked, which I would guess is like the official pick for this tool, is the Vortex Tab 75. And this has all the keys that you get with a 10 keyless keyboard, so it doesn't skimp and make you learn weird shift levels or anything like that. But there's no spaces at all between any of the keys, including the arrow keys and the page up, page down stuff. So it has this extremely compact layout. Not much larger than a magic keyboard, but you get all the benefits that you would get from a mechanical keyboard. You can have it with clicky keys. You can have it with tactile keys. You can have it with the linear ones that gamers like. And of course, you can make it look any way you like.
And so the main advantage for you is the travel that the key does by being physical. You like that feel. It's not really the sound that you're after. It's the feel of the key moving.
Yeah, that's it. And just the general snobbiness of mechanical keyboards. Just knowing that I'm participating in keyboard elitism.
I see. Well, that only works if you are kind of traveling with it so you can show it off.
Right, right. Well, I guess you can post... people who have mechanical keyboards always have Instagrams for their mechanical keyboards. The way other people, like the way people with, it's like children and pets. But
okay.
But no one ever has to grow up.
There's no like bezel around it or anything. It just looks like keys glued together. I kind of like that look.
Right, and like one of the things I like doing is like if you kind of look on Boing Boing, there's an old post I did for one of them. I think it's the Vortex 40, where I'd made a custom wood surround for one of those types which have no bezel. So it looks like the keyboard is kind of made out of wood, like something from the 1970s. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess you could substitute wooden caps. I'm sure that they must be available.
Oh, yes. Yes, there's wooden caps. There's metal caps. People make caps out of epoxy. If you kind of do a bit of poking around in the mechanical keyboard subreddits, you'll find all sorts of crazy things that people have made to go on their keyboards. There is a certain, like, they're not mass-produced gadgets. It's the same way that, say, a Logitech keyboard is. And in fact, many, like, I think the biggest part of the community is really into, like, group buy stuff. So that's where you all get together, a couple hundred people, to buy a particular model, and then you capitalize it together, almost like a Kickstarter campaign, but it's structured slightly differently. And you have to wait a year for the damn thing to turn up.
Rob, one thing I noticed is when you buy one of these keyboards, it comes with keys to swap in depending if you have a Windows machine or a Mac.
Yes. Yeah, it's a bit, even so, I think a Mac keyboard has like three keys on the bottom row to the left of the spacebar. Some mechanical keyboards, it's very difficult to make them play nicely with Mac in a way that you'll have muscle memory the same as you would with a normal Mac keyboard. Mm-hmm. But this particular model does have the standard layout, so you shouldn't have too much trouble with it at all.
Okay.
And I guess the main thing is that you're kind of optimizing, selecting, modification, personalizing something that you spend a lot of time with most days physically touching. So why not make it something that you enjoy touching?
Yeah, it seems like it's about $120, which seems like a lot of money for a keyboard, but it's the thing you interact with every day. And if you're a writer, you should do something which is fit exactly to your preferences. People will think, they won't think twice about spending $2,000 on a new computer or $500 on a fancy monitor. But the idea of spending more than $30 on a keyboard really winds some people up.
That's really cool. So yeah. So speaking of peripherals on your desk, the other thing you want to recommend is a certain kind of a mouse, a Logitech mouse.
It's the Logitech MX Vertical Mouse. And I have a little bit of repetitive strain type trouble in my right hand, and it doesn't affect.
Have you looked at your keyboard recently?
It's never been. Keyboarding has never been the trigger. The trigger has always been using a mouse, and it's kind of the back of the hand, and it's just the particular way my hand stretches. So if I was smart, I would probably adopt better posture and like hold the mouse in a more ergonomic way, but why do that when I can just buy something? And what I bought was a vertical mouse. And the idea here is the mouse is in a peculiar shape, which means that it's almost like a handshake posture rather than a hand flat on the table posture.
You're much and more natural feeling.
Right. So I tried a cheap one and probably, well, I don't know what brand it was, so I won't lie. And it stopped working after 2 weeks. And there's a brand name for vertical mice, I guess the company that kind of came up with the concept. But it has the feel and look of medical equipment. I think it has that kind of vibe to it. And they're like $200. So Logitech has muscled in on this field in the last year or so. And it has all the features and the stylish look of the brand. So I'm giving it a go. And I've got to say, I found it very difficult to get used to it. With the cheap one, I spent so much time just getting it working and then it not working that I never really figured out whether I actually liked using a mouse where I'm holding it like I'm shaking someone's hand. And the big problem is it just seems very difficult to be precise with it. At least for me, but I'm giving it a go, and it has instantly made all the pain go away without sending me to a trackpad or a stylus or some other control system that I don't want to use. I want to use a mouse. So I'm having a good time with it.
What do you use when you're painting in Photoshop?
Oh, I use an Intuos, an Intuos tablet.
Oh, okay.
Eventually, I'll probably get a Cintiq, but it's like the good ones are $1,500. And
I had a Cintiq, which I actually sold because I didn't use it enough. But part of it was the difficulty of switching back and forth. It was two things on my desktop. It was so huge, and it was one of the early models. So I went back to the little tiny, the graphite ones. They're only 8 inches or something, and I found that a better compromise for the amount that I was using it. Maybe if I was using it every day, the Cintiq might make sense.
One of the problems I have with the Wacom Cintiq is I've used an iPad Pro with a pencil, and the latency is so low that when you go back to Cintiq, or at least maybe the previous generation's models, I can't say that the new ones are the same. There's just that slight latency, and it's very difficult to go back to it. I find that with the Intuos, where it's a separate tablet from the screen, that my brain naturally accepts a bit of latency. Because it's not because I'm not writing or not painting on the same surface where I'm seeing the result, so I think that might be one of the things in the tablet's favor as opposed to Cintiq.
And why don't you just continue to use your iPad instead of even going back to a tablet peripheral?
Well, because it doesn't have Photoshop on it. And it's going to, I have a kind of a complicated blogger workflow in that I'm always swapping between different apps and tabs and so on. And it's very difficult to kind of create and maintain that workflow on an iPad. Things are probably changing now. I know there's a new version of iOS that's especially made for the iPad coming out. And I think the newer iPad Pros, this year's models, are more powerful and generally feel better when you're trying to multitask. And they also have a very kooky file system abstraction. They were always made to be like highly secure mobile devices, whereas I think most of us like to just have a pile of files on our desktop or shuttled through folders. So you can't do that with iPad apps. iOS has everything kind of sequestered in its own secure thing, and the only access they have to one another's files is through an API in the system, and it's really complicated to get used to.
My unfair summary is that the iOS is for consuming, and the OS is for producing.
Yeah,
there's just a bias there that it's easier to create in this kind of environment of the desktop, and it's wonderful to consume in the iOS.
That's a good generalization for sure. Rob, just a quick side question. Have you ever tried the iPad app called Procreate for doing your painting and drawing?
Yes, that's the one I really love. I really love using Procreate. Mm-hmm. It's just great. I also like, it's blanked from my head, but there's another one. Affinity is the other one, sorry. That I'm really into, or was, as long as I could cope with trying to work on an iPad.
I can't believe Procreate's only $10.
I know. It's got to be tough to be a business selling apps on the iPad.
Yeah.
Just the down pressure on app prices.
And so going back then to the vertical mouse, the idea is that there's like you have a scroll wheel, and how do you click? Is it with your thumb or with your fingers, or
there's that's the thing. It's like a mouse on its side, but because you've got the thumb on the other side, you can kind of click underneath it too. So there's two extra buttons underneath. I found it pretty difficult to get used to, and I'm not sure I'm used to it yet. But because the pain has gone away, I'm going to persist.
And I had some pain earlier on, and I just switched hands. And that, you know, that's a challenge because I'm right-handed. So I'm still today right now using I use it in my left hand, and being kind of ambidextrous, kind of you can give the other hand a rest. And I found it kind of easier just to switch hands than to switch a mouse.
Mm.
That's yeah, cool that you can do that. Are you like at the point where you feel comfortable with it?
Oh yeah, yeah, that's totally. Cool. I mean, yeah, it's my it's kind of my natural thing now. I just automatically go to left hand. I don't know why. I never had any trouble in my left hand, so I just kept it there. I can go back to the right if I need to.
That's it. That's interesting. That's like the artist Frank Frazetta when he had a stroke and the right side of his body was paralyzed, so he just switched to his left hand and taught himself to paint again. Yeah, it took a little while, but it was great again.
Yeah. Okay, so what's another one, Rob? What's
next on the list is am I allowed to say naughty words? It's a cheap ass Japanese pull saw.
Right, that's the technical name.
Yeah, I think they're called Ryoba saws.
I pulled up one that, looking at Amazon, the cheapest ones they have was about $19.
Yeah, that's it. I got one that's $25. Getting one of these liberated me when it came to making things out of wood.
Can you describe it, what it is, how it's different?
It's a saw which has a long, thick blade with two sides, and one side has teeth for rip cuts, and the other side has teeth for cross cuts, so for going against and with the grain on a piece of wood. And the way it's designed, you apply pressure on the pull rather than the push. And this means that the saw is always always straight rather than threatening to bend.
Mm.
So it doesn't require expert technique the way Western saws do to actually get quality results. A complete idiot can do fast, accurate cuts with one.
Right. It is sort of weird that we have, we being, you know, America, the West, saws that cut on the push, because it just makes so much more sense to cut on the pull.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was a revelation to me. Like I've got a baby son who's now almost 2 years old, and he got to the stage where he's running crazy around the house constantly, and he managed to headbutt our ancient Victorian era radiators, which he was okay, but it was immediately obvious that the design of these radiators with the metal sharp edges is just absolutely lethal. So I decided, okay, I'm going to get radiator covers, the wood ones that you buy, but because they have to be custom made to whatever size your radiator is, they cost like $200 or $300 each. And I've got like a house full of these things. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to buy the wood at the lumber yard and get a decent saw and just cut everything and just do rudimentary, straightforward ones myself. And it's so difficult to get precision. I'm getting frustrated. It's slow going. And someone just told me, just buy one of those cheap Japanese saws off of Amazon. You'll be amazed. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. Suddenly I'm like doing all these fancy cuts and everything like that, and making radiator covers that look really nice rather than just boxes. And it's all for $25.
That's crazy. That is so cool.
Yeah, they are, and sometimes you can get versions of them that have a very, they're very thin, so that the kerf, which is the cut, the width of the cut, is very, very narrow, which can increase the precision when you're doing woodworking. So that's another option, is to have, there's probably more expensive versions of these that have a very thin blade.
Yeah, it's very easy when you start looking online, I need to buy a decent saw, start Googling things like that. You know, the Reddit people will direct you to these unbelievably expensive European like back saws with incredibly fancy designs. Yeah. No, get the Japanese one from Amazon.
Yeah, and I think they're called Ryoba.
Yeah.
Is the Japanese general term, not a brand term. That's a general term for these two-sided pull saws.
That's a good one. So, Rob, I'm intrigued by this one. I took a peek. It's an Apple iMac, but it's not the latest and greatest.
No, the 2006 17-inch iMac. I think these were only made available to schools, but they're widely available on the internet.
And why would you want a almost 15-year-old computer at this point?
If you write a lot and you're not very good at focusing, maybe have a little bit of the attention deficit about you, which a lot of us writers do have, especially when the writing is on deadline. You want something which lets you focus, but which isn't completely ridiculous. So there's a whole cottage industry, almost like the keyboards, of gadgets for focused writing. And likewise, there's all sorts of apps to help you do focused writing. I don't think the apps work because you can just close the app and go back to YouTube. I don't think the gadgets work because they're all really expensive and just hinky, weird things that encompass an idea but don't really have much to them.
Yeah, they're kind of overly precious.
Right, so you may as well just use a typewriter and scan it in or something, or an Alpha Smart or one of those things. What I love, but in all those cases, it's basically a barbaric thing, loud and doesn't have any features at all. An old 2006 17-inch iMac is a nice small computer which has all the useful features of word processing software, some basic internet access if you need to look things up, but which is too slow and too primitive to do anything with but write. I don't think it can even play YouTube videos because you can't install software with the new codecs and all that stuff. And it's great. It's like a it's the focused writing machine you've always wanted if you're the person who's looking for a focused writing environment. And you just got to think about it laterally a bit. The 2006 17-inch iMac, $100 on Craigslist.
So if you were going that route, which I fully understand and can back, why wouldn't you go for like a really old laptop so you'd also have the portability aspect as well?
Well, you could. I mean, in a sense, it encompasses a whole category of machines, something which is modern enough to write on and which has some reasonable software and internet access, but which doesn't have all the things that will distract you. So an old laptop would be pretty good. What I like about the 17-inch iMac is it's really tiny. It's fixed in place. I think it being a desktop is an advantage, at least for me, because it means I sit down in a particular spot and I'm writing. I'm not somewhere out in the world thinking about other things. And I know that that's just, everyone has their own personal culture of productivity, but that's what appeals to me, the fact that it's a desktop.
And I'm looking at this website, Blink, BLINQ.com. It's $75 for a refurbished one, and the shipping is free. It's like 94% off the original price when it came out.
94%, that's great.
There is a certain cultishness to it. I think I found a few other people that like this particular model because if you kind of search for it, you'll find people who have figured out the fastest chip that will go into the motherboard inside it. And
isn't that defeating the entire purpose you just stated, which is that it can't do all these other things?
Well, here's the deal. It's so old that most models, except the very final generation, like the late 2006 models, only have a Core Solo Intel CPU, which can't run the 64-bit versions of OS X. So if you replace the CPU, you can get it running Mojave. Although I don't know if you'd really want to from such an old chip. Whereas if you don't upgrade it, you're stuck with Snow Leopard. And frankly, even with everything I've said, it is a bit of a pain in the backside to be stuck with Snow Leopard, because you have to hunt down old versions of Firefox, old versions of Rightroom, or whatever your word processor of choice is. And you have to stop it from trying to update them, all that kind of stuff, where you're trying to freeze frame a machine in time, because everything these days wants to update itself until it's broken.
I can smell an opportunity for some side hustle of a guy who's buying these and then doing all that hard work of installing, pre-installing the word processor and everything you need, so you have a usable writer's platform on this thing, and he ships the whole thing ready.
Yeah,
that would be perfect. A guy did that with those old Tandy kind of word processors that look like a keyboard with a little LCD display attached to them.
All right, so I'm giving that idea away. Yeah. Go ahead, internet, just steal that one.
There was there's a similar device called the Alpha Smart, which is more like a laptop. And I think that's probably, of all these, this kind of thing that I'm talking about here, that is the cult device. And there's definitely a few guys who make a living polishing these things up and preparing them for sale on eBay.
I had one somewhere, which I never could use because it doesn't really have a screen. It has a screen that shows like five lines of text.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hate them.
It was very, very unuser-friendly from my point of view.
I don't rate them.
I would be much preferred to use an old laptop that, you know, could at least boot up Word.
Yeah.
And then you want to be able to get it off somehow or other. So, it'd have a modem. I don't know what you would do with that.
One thing I would recommend to people is, they're hard to find now, but the NEC Mobile Pro was one of those Windows CE gadgets that were briefly, I don't know if they're really popular, but companies bought them by the thousand for a while, so they had their time. And the NEC Mobile Pro is like a nice keyboard with a screen in the aspect ratio of a keyboard, almost like a CinemaScope screen. And it's a little clamshell laptop. It's instant on when you open it, even though it's ancient. And it has one app on it, and it's Microsoft Office. And and so that was pretty good. But I think at this point it's so old that it would probably require a little bit of hacking to get stuff on and off of it, like work.
So, Rob, in the few minutes that we have left, tell us about this web-based app that you've created called txt.fyi.
Oh, right. So everyone in the last couple of years has been reacting against the sort of pervasive and invasive qualities of social media and publication stuff. And I think there were a few platforms which had come about, which people got a bit disappointed in as they pivoted from one model of publishing to another. And you know, and everything's complicated. You couldn't just go online and just publish something and then share a URL. There was always some complexity. There's always tracking and all sorts of other things that you would that would get in the way of it. And then there'd be likes and sharing systems, which would kind of fill you with anxiety about how popular what you were publishing was. So I just went online. Or just create something where people can go online, hammer out some text, hit publish, and it's published. You don't have to log in. There's no social media, social capital stuff, none of that stuff. And you can use Markdown or plain text. And like hundreds of things are published on it a day, even though there's virtually no public discussion or profile over it, apart from someone at Wired figured it out and wrote an article about it. And
so the idea is that when you hit the publish button, the text is then posted on the web. Mm-hmm. It has a URL, yep, which you can share. Is that the idea?
You can share if you want to, but it's not syndicated anywhere. You're the only person who knows it exists.
Right. But the word publish means to share. So at some level, you are publishing it to share it, right? And so there is a shareable URL that you can pass around.
Sure, you can.
It's but it's not being promoted on its own. It would depend on you publicizing
exactly. it. You would have to publicize it on another medium. So to share what you have published on Text FYI, you would have to publish something else somewhere else.
Sure. Like your followers or your WhatsApp or yeah. something like that.
So it kind of functions as a paste bin type thing, but with a very strong sense of what it is.
And presumably, I mean, if I was a writer putting, and I didn't have anywhere else, and I was just kind of writing there, my question would be, well, how long is this going to be around? Will this be around in 5 years? And if it was to go away, would I ever know it? Or was there, you know, what are you doing about that?
The only thing between Text FYI and Annihilation is me. So there is a trust element of that, in that when you're doing it, in a sense, I am publishing it, which is, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. One of the things that made me want to do it was frustration at how complicated federated publishing is. Well, a lot of the new social media and publishing environments have an extremely complicated distributed vibe to them, which is very appealing to nerds, and especially ones like us who are interested in privacy and trust. But it's completely impossible for grandmas and people who just want to write little notes to themselves that they can compile on their desktop later. It's not a wonderful thing. It says on the page, it's the dumbest platform, the dumbest platform, and it is. But some people just want a Just Works dumb publishing platform, and so that's what it is. It costs, even with the volume of posting, which is probably, I mean, it's nothing compared to anything else, but even with plenty of people using it, it costs me about $10 a month. I was very careful. Well, everything is published as a plain HTML file. There's no JavaScript. There's not even a database. It's so simple. Although the file system is a database, technically.
So if someone forgot the URL of a piece of text, it's
too
gone.
Bad. It's all gone. You know, in truth,
can Google find it?
Nope. It's all if there was like a hostile search engine that ignored the no cache and you published the URL to somewhere like on Twitter, then you know, I know that there's at least two people out there who are compiling known text FYI pages. But they've got, you know, they've got like 40, because that's as many as people have ever posted about publicly. There's actually like 40 gigabytes of them.
Wow. So this is sort of, I like the idea of a kind of a very private type of publishing, which is also what this generates, is that you somewhat ability where you can actually share things that sort of are private just by the nature of where they are.
Yeah, I don't even know what's on it. I just look in now and again to make sure that it's not being conspicuously abused. And so sometimes I'll see what someone's just written because I'm looking through the logs or whatever. But those logs are very short. It's like, it's just a functional thing for that, you know, looking at what the server, you know, just the default from a server. And to be honest, I should get rid of that, because the whole thing, I like the idea of there being no record of anything at all other than what people know themselves. So if I were to take the time to revise it, I would maybe have someone configure a custom web server and an operating system that kept no logs at all. Although I guess that starts to look a bit suspicious at that point. I don't know. I think if one of the things is, it's so useless that spammers don't have any use for it. Harassers don't have any use for it. There are a few spammers will use it the way they use paste bin. But even then it's so unfit for any purpose, but but personal notes or sharing a few words with other people.
Have you ever thought of like link having the storage be like a cooperative storage cloud of some kind, where it's, you know, networked online storage, and that way you even if shut off your storage servers, people could still use it.
That's a really good idea, and it's probably what I should do next. Rather than just
right, so it's no longer not depend on even on you. It's just kind of as right. long as somebody's interested, it'll continue.
Well, that's the thing. The whole thing is such a tiny. There's almost no code to it. It's just one one file. Anyone who is a competent programmer could make this themselves. When it blew up on Hacker News, someone said, "I could make this in a weekend," as they do. And I had the pleasure of saying, "I made it in 3 hours."
That's great, yeah. And you made it, and he didn't, too.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
If there's a magic to this, it's that no one wants this. There's no possibility of making money from it. In a vague way, it's always a lurking anxiety that you're responsible for it. And I never see what people do with it. So I get no pleasure from any kind of social activity or the creative work of other people that other people are doing on it. So the only reason it doesn't exist more widely is because no one wants it, no one likes it, and no one can imagine creating anything like it.
That's perfect.
Right.
Well, thank you for taking time to make such a unwanted thing.
Right.
Well, Rob, this has been great talking to you as usual. It's always a pleasure to find out what you're up to.
All right. Yeah, thanks, guys.
It was wonderful and great tools too. Thanks.